And I just had this moment of clarity where I realized that if I took another step forward, if we kept going away from the camp, we were just going to die. We were not going to get up, and we probably wouldn't be able to find the camp again.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host Ben Pronk. G'day, Ben.
G'day, Tim.
Ben, 20 years ago, a team of four Australian SAS guys were on the subantarctic Heard Island, endeavouring to be only the third climbing party to summit Mawson's Peak, otherwise known as Big Ben, which is Australia's only active volcano. And in RV12, I talked a little bit about this climbing trip as being one of my Everests. Since RV12, we've had a few requests to hear the full story. And I thought that 20 years having been passed, it's probably an appropriate moment for a little reflection. So to set the scene, we put ashore on the 1st of January 2000 after nearly a month at sea on an 88-metre fishing trawler called the Southern Champion, which at the time was Australia's largest fishing trawler. We all worked in the fish factory through the incredibly challenging Southern Ocean, and that in itself is a story worth telling. Well, 20 years later, you and I have got the climbing party back together. Stu and Matt are still serving as SAS officers, and Rob Clifton is now in a senior role at the Australian Antarctic Division. In fact, after his time as an SAS sniper troop commander, Rob became the youngest ever station leader at Macquarie Island, another subantarctic island, and Rob has been at Australian Antarctic Division ever since. I often describe this trip for me as being profoundly spiritual, untouched flora and fauna. There are no introduced species on Heard Island. There was an imposing volcano, a summit to climb, and of course, a series of accompanying glaciers. There was always the element of profound danger. And I've previously talked to you, Ben, about at one point in this particular mission, accepting that my fate was going to be to die on our first push for the summit. But thinking back 20 years, the most spiritual part for me really was being there with the three guys I climbed with. We could only rely on each other. We were 3,500 kilometres away from any medical care or 7 days sailing, assuming we could get communications with the Southern Champion. We had moments facing failure, and we were constantly confronting profound risk. Matt, Rob and Stu remain the toughest and most genuine and generous friends that one can have. And the way they tell this story in such a matter-of-fact way is testament to that humility. The memories of them and Heard will always remain some of my fondest. So let's have them tell this story of adventure. Let's get on with the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I'm sitting in our nation's capital of Canberra, joined as always by my co-host Tim. G'day, Tim.
G'day, Ben.
Now, as Tim's mentioned in a couple of previous episodes, we've heard a little bit about his exploits in the Great Southern Ocean. However, we've had a number of people asking to hear a bit more about it. And this being the 20th year of this expedition, we've been lucky enough to be able to gather together the majority of the expedition members to talk in depth about their visit to Heard Island and their climbing exploits there. Tim.
That's right. So all the way in Tasmania, Rob Clifton, who once upon a time was also in the regiment with us, now works for Antarctic Division. Welcome, Rob.
G'day, Tim. Good to be here, mate.
And Matt the president of the Army Alpine Association. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks, Tim.
I thought the logical place to start would be a little bit about Heard Island, where it is, and some of the history. And Rob, you're probably the best placed person to give that info. Could you tell us a little bit about Heard Island?
Sure. So Heard Island is a very small speck in the Southern Ocean. It's a few thousand kilometres southwest of Perth. So it is literally in the middle of nowhere. It's a pretty amazing place. So it's about a 20-kilometre diameter circular island. It's a volcano. It's Australia's active volcano. And it rises up out of the ocean to about 2,750 metres in altitude. It's you know, sitting down there in the furious 50s, so the wind kind of whips around Antarctica and comes screaming around from South America under Africa and then slams into Little Heard Island sitting there in the Southern Ocean. So it's a place of incredibly wild weather, and it's a very, very exposed spot. Yeah, so it's pretty special, really. Amazing glaciers, so much of the island is covered in ice and snow. But there is a fringe around the coast that is ice-free in areas, and that provides a bit of a toehold for quite a few species of animals to live and breed, particularly in the summer months. So there's a couple of seal species, there's four penguin species, there's about three albatross species and a range of other seabirds, petrels and so on, that kind of breed on the island in summer. So summer's a pretty incredible time there because the place is obviously teeming with this breeding wildlife that's come ashore out of the Southern Ocean, and away they go. Yeah, so a pretty incredible place. It was discovered in the 1800s by sealers, in fact, and had a bit of a history of sealing gangs living and working on the island. And there's still the remains of some of their huts and artifacts and so on the island from those days. They pretty much decimated the seal population when they were there. But those populations are bouncing back, which is really cool. Yeah, and of course, being an active volcano is pretty amazing as well, and I guess a bit poignant at the moment in what's just happened in New Zealand. But that's certainly a dynamic element of the island as well.
And Australian Antarctic Division's got a long history there, Rob. When did AAD first start programs on Heard Island?
Yeah, so that was in the 1940s, and in fact, the AAD was in the late 40s, and the AAD was looking towards going onto the Antarctic continent, so eventually established Mawson Station on the Antarctic continent itself, but used Heard Island as a kind of a stepping stone towards that. So established its first station on Heard Island and had people there, and then from there moved onto the continent. So there's a long history of Antarctic Division programs on the island.
And if you were to go there today, what would you find in terms of the history of the Antarctic Division?
Well, there are still a few huts there, and there's in Atlas Cove, which is on the western side of the island, there are the remains of the original Antarctic Division station. So there's a few huts and so on remaining there. But that's about all you'd find. There are a couple of other small huts scattered around the island, but one of the really nice things about Heard is that it's still relatively untouched. And in fact, it's quite unique, really, in the sub-Antarctic islands in that it doesn't have any introduced species on it. So that's quite an important facet of the island and a reason why the biosecurity of the island is very well protected these days.
And if you wanted to visit, firstly, can you visit? And if so, how do you get there?
We absolutely can visit. So you would need to apply for a permit, which is what we had to do for that trip of ours. And that requires a bit of an environmental evaluation and, you know, coming up with some kind of mitigation measures to reduce the chance of, you know, you introducing some kind of species inadvertently or having an impact on the island. And then you need to get there. But I think getting there is the hard part because it is in the middle of nowhere. It's not on any shipping routes. It's a pretty rugged piece of ocean to traverse. So, yeah, essentially you need to get hold of a ship or a yacht or some kind of vessel and get down there. And various expeditions over the years that have gone there have gone on a range of vessels, ranging from sailing boats to old trawlers and all sorts of things. But I think the location of Heard and the difficulty in getting there is kind of part of its allure, if you like.
There's a really nice quote from Doug Thost, who I understand was a former glaciologist with the Australian Antarctic Division, and he says, and I quote, "Being in such a remote and wild place is pretty humbling. You have to be very aware of the potential danger you could be in and how unlucky it is that you could be rescued if something does go wrong, but it's invigorating." So that said, who came up with this mad idea to travel 4,000 kilometres southwest of Perth and go and climb this mountain? Matt.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting question because it was one of those ideas that evolved over time. At that time, the four of us, the four expedition members, were all serving in SASR in Perth. We're all keen climbers, mainly rock climbers, I guess. We'd done a few bits and pieces in New Zealand and the like. But the idea of Heard Island was quite elusive. But I think it came to us through another friend who had previously planned an expedition there a long time ago and had never got there because of all these logistic difficulties that Cliffo was talking about before. So I guess we took that up and developed it and happily got lucky with the transport.
And the original four did not include me. I was very fortunate that one of the members was sent to East Timor and a spot opened up. And in a chronic case of imposter syndrome, I think I was invited onto the trip and life-changing for me personally. So let's talk about getting there. How did we negotiate to get down to Heard Island?
Yeah, well, it was a great opportunity that we grabbed. It was one which really started with the legal fishing that occurs down at Heard Island. It's an Australian territory, and therefore Australian boats under fairly strict regimes are able to fish the really large remaining stocks of fish that exist on the plateau surrounding Heard Island. It's called Kerguelen Plateau. That area is really rich in marine life, and so there's a couple of companies, and one in particular that's fishing down there very successfully. And so we really had the opportunity to pitch our proposal to them, and they were surprisingly, they were actually accommodating, and they said, sure, you can come along.
So they had a fishing vessel called the Southern Champion, which at the time, 88 metres long, was the largest fishing vessel certainly in Australia, and it was a fish factory. So they fished and did everything on board, right down to freezing the fish, and when it was taken off, it was ready to go directly to market. Rob, peculiarly, how did the voyage start? So you'd think logically you'd try and jump off at the closest point to Heard, but that didn't happen.
Yeah, that's right. So I remember that we were set to leave from Fremantle, in fact, and that was the plan that we were working towards. And then in a bit of a twist, the fishing company came to us and said, actually, the boat's coming into Mauritius, not Fremantle, and it's going to reprovision and refuel and change crew over and so on in Mauritius and then go to Heard, which caused us to, you know, change plans a bit. But in fact, the fishing company was fantastic, and I recall they were sending a container, 20-foot container over with some nets and so on in it from Perth to Mauritius to meet the boat, and gave us some space in that. So we loaded two Zodiac inflatable boats and our tents and rations and all the climbing gear and so on into that container that then went over to Mauritius. And then we got ourselves some tickets and flew to Mauritius to join the boat there.
And we had a little bit of time in Port Louis in Mauritius enjoying the sunshine, and then we joined the Southern Champion. Let's talk about the voyage south, Matt. We didn't have to work for passage, but we all contributed on board. You want to tell us some anecdotes about that voyage south?
Yeah.
Which wasn't a fast one from memory.
No, I mean, this was really one of the things that set this expedition apart, certainly in my mind, from many of the other trips I've done, in that it had this extraordinary experience on the boat, both getting down there and getting back. So we sort of jumped on board this thing and were really just introducing ourselves to the captain and crew, which were a bunch of, I think, 35 or 37 odd trawlermen who were some of the, as you could imagine, were some had some very interesting life stories and often a fairly rough backgrounds, and so it was a really interesting time for us to sort of get to know these guys. And the captain made it pretty clear right at the start that it would be probably better if we worked on the way down. And we, of course, scratched our heads a bit and thought, well, there must be a whole bunch of reasons why we can't do that in terms of training and stuff like that. But we were pretty quickly convinced that would be the easiest way to do things.
And how did we work?
Well, that was, I often say this is some of the hardest work I've done in my life. 8 hours on, 8 hours off, just round the clock. We found ourselves in the fish factory. That's where sort of life starts. And this is think of a big industrial kitchen with tons of fish coming in one end on a conveyor belt, and you standing there with some very, very dangerous bandsaws and other bits and pieces, chopping the heads off fish and generally stacking them and then freezing them. And then also working above deck, really just getting all the rigging and nets going as these huge trawl nets are thrown into the ocean and then pulled back up with literally tons and tons of fish.
And of course, the factory wasn't nice and flat. It was pitching and rolling and yawing. Rob, what were the conditions? We took a little while the vessel was fishing down the coast of Africa, but what were the conditions once we headed further south into the Southern Ocean?
Yeah, I remember it getting pretty rugged, in fact, and, it was that classic kind of, big wind and big seas. Luckily, we didn't encounter anything too nasty, but it was certainly a fairly rough passage. And I also recall that we were fishing for a species of fish called orange roughy in those waters on the way south. And there was a time there where the fishing was so good that the boat was thinking of maybe not even going to Heard Island on that trip, because they were going to fill up with this other species, orange roughy, where they're going to be targeting Patagonian toothfish once they got down to the Kerguelen Plateau that Matt spoke about. So I can remember it being a pretty interesting time, because we were working pretty hard in the factory. The ship was very much in motion on the Southern Ocean. It was rough, and we were also kind of faced with this potential maybe just, going back to Mauritius or going back into Albany and never seeing Heard Island. So I can remember there was, there was a bit of despondency at times about were we actually going to get to this elusive island.
And it was a sponsored trip, so that added some additional pressure, Matt?
Yeah, well, we had a couple of sponsors. That was sort of, again, one of the ways we were trying to keep costs down on it, but it all seems probably a bit amateur now. But we'd rushed around and got a couple of companies to help us out with some of our radio equipment, GPSs, things like that. And also I was sort of the techie and comms guy, and so we had a wind generator. I realised that power supply on the island is always a bit of a challenge, and it's not very sunny down there, but it sure as hell is windy. So a small wind generator that you'd normally find on the back of a yacht was what we wanted, and so we got the lend of one of those. And so, yeah, we had some responsibilities, I guess, to sponsors to make sure we'd fly their flag for them.
Which is certainly, you know, an interesting dimension to the trip, and maybe we circle back on that a little bit later. So enter the Southern Ocean, and did you get seasick, Matt?
No, I was fine. I mean, that was one of the really interesting things about the trip, was that some of the team members were water operators in the regiment, that is, hard as nails, small boats, you know, used to this sort of stuff, and they seemed exclusively to be the people that got us sick as dogs and rarely emerged from their cabin, in fact.
Yeah, that's right. And Stu, hardened water operator, I had the responsibility as the medic, no experience, but I'd have a go. And he was lying very ill in his cabin one day, cried out for some seasickness medication. I brought it in with a bucket, and he sat up promptly and threw up directly in my face, missing the bucket completely. Rob, thoughts on the Southern Ocean, and maybe even a comment on the Patagonian toothfish?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you know, the Southern Ocean is this very large, you know, kind of circumpolar expanse of ocean that, again, there's not much stopping it building up a head of steam, so there's not very little land mass down south. So you certainly get the largest waves on the planet, and you get the most wind on the planet as it circles around Antarctica. So it's a pretty wild place. Yeah, interesting. And the Patagonian toothfish is, you know, fascinating fish, that it's often sold as sea bass or Chilean sea bass in restaurants. And it's a firm, white-fleshed fish that chefs actually like, because they can put it with various sauces and so on. It's not, hasn't got a terribly distinctive or strong flavour itself, but, you know, is very popular and was you know, really overfished for many years by illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing boats. And there was a major campaign, which is really quite successful, a real success story in fisheries conservation terms, in stopping those illegal boats and then just having what is now a really well-regulated fishery by legal regulated boats. So it's quite a success story in terms of getting rid of the pirates, if you like, and then having a good and well-managed industry.
Yeah, so the Patagonian toothfish, I find, you know, it's really interesting, because this is, in many ways, the whole reason we were down there, or the reason we got down there, was because of this, the fact that we could hitch a ride on this trawler. And so I remember when the first Patagonian toothfish came up into the fish factory, I was standing there in my gumboots and overalls, stinking of fish, you know, the ship pitching and rolling about 60 degrees each way. And this thing comes up on this conveyor belt, and just instinctively I reach down to pick it up to have a look at this big fish. It's almost a meter long. It's a big, big fish, huge, great big teeth on the front of it. And the thing turns around in its death throes and tries to take my fingers off. I was astounded. This thing had been fished out of almost a kilometre deep of water, and yet it was still alive. Most fish have swim bladders, and therefore when they get hauled to the surface, they're dead. This thing doesn't, and so it was still alive and kicking. So it was a bit of a frightening introduction to the Patagonian toothfish, the reason we were down there.
And maybe one final comment on the toughness of those fishermen and women, the fisher people on board that vessel, who continued to fish regardless of the sea state and the weather. Thoughts on that, Rob?
Yeah, well, they were a fantastic bunch. I mean, they seemed to me to be the classic salt of the earth, you know, fundamentally really nice bunch of people, but they were hard as nails. And, you know, that was the environment that they fished and worked in. And, you know, they would do that and then they would go back to shore. And, you know, some of them would spend most of their money before getting back onto the boat again to go back onto the ocean again fishing. So, yeah, it was actually a fascinating part of the trip was to interact with those folks. And they were so good to us. They were really, really good to us.
Mm. And it became apparent that we were going to get ashore on New Year's Eve, 1999. There was a certain stillness in the Southern Ocean as we edged closer to Heard Island. Not much darkness. And I personally remember being on the bridge. It was about 2 a.m. feeling this real expectation and anticipation, a bit like a boy on Christmas morning. Do you remember that pre-departure moment, Matt?
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. And of course, the turnover of the new year in 1999 to 2000 was pretty significant. Many of the listeners can probably remember perhaps what they were doing then. But one of the big deals at that point was the Y2K problem that everyone thought they'd have. So this is where many of the computers of that time were programmed in a way that perhaps people were uncertain, but they thought there might be some significant glitches or problems with technology as the clock ticked over to 2000. And this included the boat. So, for example, all the GPS that they had on board, which they use almost exclusively for navigation, this may not actually work. There were some concerns that it wouldn't. So it was funny to see all these, senior guys pulling out sextants and compasses and trying to remember how this all worked. They would have all been trained on it, but they certainly didn't use it day to day. So that was a really interesting aside. But as it turned out, as many of us know, the Y2K bubble burst. There was no real big issues, and we sailed on towards Heard.
So New Year's Day, ready to Zodiacs, and the crew got a bit of benefit out of this too, didn't they, Rob? Very rare for any fisherman to put ashore at Atlas Cove on Heard Island. Experiences as we gently motored into Atlas Cove?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, I remember it being a relatively calm day and we motored in no problems and were met on the beach by some southern elephant seals and, you know, there were penguins around in the water and on shore and so on. And so it was pretty exciting. And I think after all the time at sea and the kind of potential thought that maybe we weren't going to get there and then we were going to get there and so pretty mixed emotions, it was really quite amazing to arrive on the island itself and step ashore. I remember it as a pretty special moment, in fact.
And flora and fauna, outside of the elephant seals, what else greeted us in Atlas Cove?
Well, my memory was there were a few fur seals around and some gentoo penguins on the beach as well. So, it was kind of like a great introduction to that sub-Antarctic wildlife.
Yeah, and I mean, the amazing thing was that all these animals had basically never seen humans before. And so, because given that the island only gets visited occasionally with scientific parties, and so us rocking up on the beach was a complete novelty. And these, my sense was that all these animals just thought we were a sort of a slightly different coloured, larger seal or penguin that had come ashore. And so there was no real sense of fear. They were wandering all around. I mean, I remember, I think it was a king penguin, a larger penguin, just came up and sort of walked right up to me and sort of was standing on my toes, sort of having a bit of a peck at me and a bit of a look at me as if I was just some other species that had emerged on the beach.
Mm, and there's clear restrictions, isn't there, Rob, on how close you can go to seals and penguins?
That's right, yeah. There are very strict environmental guidelines. But, of course, the penguins and seals aren't briefed on those guidelines. So if they decide to break the approach distance, then that's their prerogative, and they do it quite regularly, in fact, yeah.
Just one more thought on the landing. As we planned this trip, the landing was one of the key points of risk for us, because previous expeditions, and there'd only been two successful ascents of the mountain, the first one had suffered a bad rollover on some boats as they tried to get ashore. And so we were aware that particularly if the seas were up, getting ashore was going to be one of the more dangerous parts of the expedition. And so we were pretty keyed up. Well, I certainly was. I remember being pretty keyed up. And again, pretty pleased that the weather was good. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, I hope the weather's good as we try and leave this place as well.
Yeah, that's right. And we went ashore in exposure suits, dry suits, ready for the worst case scenario, which was trying to navigate a horrendous beach break into Atlas Cove. All right, let's get climbing. We had a night or two in Atlas Cove. Do you guys remember what happened on the first night that kind of put us a little bit on the back foot?
Yeah, I mean, it was a rough start. Again, in our planning, we decided that given the data we had on the place with wind and the weather, that we probably needed to take double up on our tents. We had these, you know, brilliant four season mountaineering tents, but we thought just to be safe, we'll take four of them. We only needed two for the trip. But we thought we'd take some extra ones, and we put them up in a fairly sheltered spot on the beach. And that first night, both tents were destroyed in the conditions, in the wind. And so that sort of really put us back a bit, and we realised that things were fairly serious and it was going to be a struggle.
Rob, can you contextualise the weather for us? What sort of weather does Heard Island experience?
Yeah, so largely the main factor there, I think, is wind, Tim. So, it's in the furious 50s. It's about 54 degrees south latitude. So it just gets these screaming westerly winds that, as I kind of was talking about in the intro, come around underneath South Africa, don't have any land to moderate them and whistle through the Southern Ocean. So the defining weather element, I reckon, on Heard Island is wind, and it is almost always up. And the other thing to note is that the wind is a westerly, and we were on the western side of the island. So I have been back to the island since this climbing expedition on scientific expeditions at the eastern end, and it's kind of like the banana coast up the east. There's sunshine and not so much wind. Whereas we had somewhat naively, I think, chosen the probably most exposed and worst part of the island to be on in regards to wind and weather.
And considering wind chill, how cold does it get on Heard, Rob?
Well, it's a classic, maritime climate. So generally the temperature, I would say, hovers between about -5 and then possibly, 2 or 3 degrees. But then, wind chill factors in and you're probably looking at around -15, -20 with wind chill. That's down on the coast. Of course, once we started climbing and got some altitude, I remember finding it much colder. And when that was combined with the wind, it was actually quite a dangerous environment.
So let's get climbing, Matt.
Yeah, so we were there for to get to the top of Big Ben, the enormous active volcano that really forms the island, 2,700 metres high, an extraordinary feature that had only ever been climbed twice before, once in the early 60s on an expedition of mainly Australians, sailed down there, skippered by the expedition leader, a guy called Bill Tillman, who's a legend in sort of early and sort of mid 20th century expeditions, an amazing man. And so they'd got to the top, and then in the 80s, there'd been another Australian expedition that had also sailed down there. And so to have a mountain that tall that had only had two ascents was quite extraordinary. And so we were pretty keen to be the third team to make it to the top. But that was a lot harder than perhaps we first expected.
And how do you go about climbing a mountain like that, Matt?
So we used a sort of a classic expedition technique where you, at the base of the mountain, you shuffle loads to build camps progressively up the mountain. And then we changed to what's called alpine style, where you're basically carrying everything on your back and you just push from your highest camp up and just put progressively higher camps in to the summit and then get down again. And so it was a and the actual techniques that you use, you're climbing them, and this is a mountain that's skirted by large glaciers and quite steep terrain, ice cliffs and rock cliffs. And so it was a case of crampons, ice axes, and ropes. The ropes are really important because of the danger of crevasses.
Rob, can you talk about the glacier, the crevasses? And we had a couple of mini falls, but fortunately no one fell deeply, you kind of waste and stopped by a pack. But the glaciers and that that architecture on Heard.
Yeah, I mean, I think the glaciers on Heard are fantastic. I mean, sadly, with climate change now, they're retreating significantly. So that's a real shame. But certainly when we were there on this trip, those glaciers, which essentially terminate at the ocean, so they've got, you know, wave-washed glacier fronts, which is a fantastic feature, and they are basically tumbling down off this, you know, 2,700-metre mountain down along its flanks and into the ocean, with some pretty big crevasses as well. So, I mean, I think one of the challenges for us in climbing the mountain, but in some ways an enjoyable challenge, was that we weren't climbing on a known route. We didn't know how to get to the top, and we were having to, you know, navigate that kind of terrain while also trying to gain altitude. And we really didn't know what we were going to find in front of us each day.
And if someone got injured, Matt, what was the medical evacuation plan?
It was pretty difficult because we were really only going to help ourselves on the island, and then potentially we would have the boat that got us down there would have to stop fishing, hopefully come on in, pick us up, and then evacuate us to the nearest major hospital, which was back in Perth, so 7 days sailing away. So yeah, it was really a case of managing that risk effectively, which meant really not getting hurt, not triggering that evacuation process.
So carrying loads to advance base camp, then on to camp one in a year, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, Rob, that Mawson's Peak, the summit, is shrouded in cloud for 360 days a year.
Yeah, so it's pretty rare that you actually get a view of the summit of the mountain. So I think that was one of the real challenges. And I remember us climbing in largely cloudy, kind of whiteout conditions and trying to navigate our way in the right direction to be going up, and then, you know, traversing various obstacles as we came across them. So I really felt for quite a while that we were climbing blind. But then I remember getting a fairly clear day somewhere, I think it was above about Camp 1, and we went out and kind of did a reconnaissance of the route and, you know, shot some compass bearings and got a bit of an idea of how we could go upwards. And so that was a real saviour for us, I think, getting that little bit of clear weather.
And it was above Camp 1, Matt, that we started to experience some more difficulties, some challenges.
Yeah, well, it was really the environmental. So the weather was terrible, and we sort of, I guess we knew it was going to be terrible, but just the effect that was having on us, on our equipment, our sleeping bags, our tents, they were really starting, particularly like the tents were starting to get pretty badly shredded, broken poles and the like. The temperature range that Rob spoke of earlier is really interesting. Like, I've climbed in much colder conditions, but it's actually better if it stays cold, whereas the conditions we had would often be hovering around zero. So you'd actually get quite wet and you'd get rain falling. So you get pretty wet. And then the temperature would just plummet. And so whatever gear was wet would just freeze solid. And so, for example, a couple of our sleeping bags by mid-trip were pretty solid blocks of ice in places. And so that's obviously makes for some fairly difficult conditions.
And from memory, at one point we'd completely run out of fuel and we were very low on food.
Yeah, so towards the end of the trip, right at our top camp, we really had to make some decisions about whether to keep going or whether to retreat, whether to head back where we had some supplies lower on the mountain. And we knew we really only had one shot. And I think we were all very keen to get up on top of the mountain. I mean, a friend of mine describes mountaineering as having a bit of a bipolarity where you have to, on one side of your brain, have a homicidal desire to get to the top of the thing. And yet you also have to have this very calculated understanding of the risks involved and your own performance and how you're going. And so we're at that point where we really wanted to get up, but we knew that the tables are really turning. We were, as you said, we're out of food, almost out of gas, which of course the problem there is you're not just out of cooking. You can't melt snow to make water. And of course without water, you can't do anything. So we were right on the limits. And the weather was still terrible, and we couldn't, we weren't yet in a position to have a shot at the summit.
But the decision was made not to climb down, resupply, and have another go, Matt. What do you think about that decision in retrospect?
Well, it was clearly the right one, because I think that's what I was pushing for. It was really interesting, and again, some of the best parts of climbing, certainly the bits you remember the most vivid moments are the hard bits, the bits that where things are not going well. I remember we were all stashed in one of our small slightly tattered tents. We were all in a pretty bad way, and we had a great a couple of really big discussions about what to do and how to manage the risk best. And the decision, I think, collectively was to stick it out for one more day. And it's still really clear in my mind, this moment where we said, okay, we'll give it one more day, but tomorrow we definitely have to go down, because we were really completely on wood in terms of food and fuel. And so fortunately, when that day dawned, it was clear, which was remarkable. There was almost no wind and it was clear skies.
And the day before that, we did have a little failed attempt to push for the summit, and it was only you and I that I think set off on that particular day. Matt, do you remember that one?
Yeah, and again, that was that, when I spoke about that bipolarity, that was the first part of my brain working there. I just wanted to get to the top. On recollection, we should never have left the tents, but we got all our protective gear on, we got roped up, harnesses, crampons, and away we went, and we pushed above our top camp, probably only a couple of hundred metres into the teeth of this terrible storm. It was windy, sleeting, and I remember standing sort of at this point, leaning into the wind, Tim with you behind me on the rope, and I just had this moment of clarity where I realised that if I took another step forward, if we kept going away from the camp, we were just going to die. We were not going to get up, and we probably wouldn't be able to find the camp again. And so, happily, that second part of my brain kicked in, and we turned around and went happily back to the tents.
It's funny you say that. It just sent a shiver up my spine, because walking into that complete whiteout, 12 metres of rope, and I couldn't see you. That's how bad it was. I'd resigned myself that I was going to die. And I also felt this incredible feeling of just being a coward when ultimately I stopped and we circled up for that conversation. I thought, I'm just being super selfish in wanting to go back down, and maybe we could have got there. So interesting that I hear you say something similar.
Mm.
So back to the tents we go. We huddle up. It's incredibly cold. We decide not to climb down the next day necessarily, but to keep an open mind. And we hear a zip go up at the front of our tent, and in walks who, Matt?
Cliffy.
Mr. Rob Clifton. And Rob, if I remember this correctly, you came in with your gloves on your feet and a woolly hat on, and that was around about it, saying, boys, I'm incredibly cold. Can you describe how that all came about?
Yeah, I had a pretty rough night, and Stu and I were sharing a tent, and in the rain in the earlier days, it had got quite wet, and my sleeping bag had been frozen. So I had just spent a fairly cold night and had chilled right down and kind of, you know, realised that I was, you know, getting, you know, what I felt was kind of dangerously cold, and that, you know, lying in my soggy, frozen sleeping bag probably wasn't the best option for me at that stage.
So there we were, two broken tents, now only three sleeping bags, one more night to spare at least, but four bodies in three sleeping bags. So the upside for you, Rob, is that you got to share a sleeping bag with me. How unpleasant was that night?
It was pretty unpleasant, but I was warmer than I would have been in my bag, so I think you did your job really well, Tim. Yeah, but I remember being comfortably spooned with you for the evening in a single-person sleeping bag. I was warm, so I didn't care, to be honest.
Mountaineering bags are not built for two, those mountaineering sleeping bags, and it was not comfortable
Funnily enough, they're not, no. But I think that, you know, Matt was talking earlier about, you know, we had this long discussion about what we were going to do the next day, and it really was. I mean, I think I remember Matt or someone saying it was kind of the last roll of the dice, you know. It was really make or break that next day, because it was just wasn't tenable, you know, food, fuel, equipment damage, and fatigue. We either had to go up or we just had to go back down.
Not much darkness, so as dawn broke and we opened the tent from our very uncomfortable night, Rob, but Matt clearly far more comfortable, what did we see?
Well, it was just amazing. It was, it's interesting because the first thing, of course, was the smell, and that might sound weird, but I'd been smelling this sulphurous gas for about the last 12 hours, and I obviously assumed it was Stu, who's feet are famous for their toxicity, but it wasn't. It was actually a lava flow that was only a couple of hundred metres from our tent, but because of the conditions, we didn't even see it. We didn't even know it was there, and yet that morning it was clear, and so you could see this big black river effectively, you know, melted down through the ice, and it wasn't very far away, and there was a plume of sulphur gas coming off it, and this was this smell that we could smell.
And the last thing we would have wanted to discover the day before was being surprised by that lava. And so we make a decision, we're going to have a go.
Yeah, I mean, it was obvious at that point that this was the day. And again, there's a bit of serendipity with a lot of climbing. Sometimes, you know, fate smiles on you, and this was one of these days that it was the reward for sticking it out. And you don't get a day like that often on Herd. In fact, you don't get a day like that often in the mountains. And so a clear, still day, it was a matter of putting our boots on as fast as we could. We went really light. I don't recall taking a rope, and we just hammered. We just went for the summit.
That's right. There was no rope. You and I set off, and in the back of my mind, I think we might have had a discussion before we left. I thought probably no chance that Rob and Stu would come up to follow us. And about 1 vertical kilometre, I think, from memory, from that top camp to the summit, and perhaps halfway, I turned around, and probably one of the most inspiring sights, Rob, I've ever had in my life, down just coming out of a sodden and broken tent, were Rob and Stu, and they were going to have a red hot crack. And I was yelling over the wind, it was still very windy, very cold, to Matt, saying, "Matt, look, look." And we both looked down, it was incredibly uplifting. Your decision to continue to the summit, Rob, despite being a bit ill?
Yeah, I think it was just that, you know, what Matt was talking about was just that desire to get there, and we could see the objective in front of us, and we thought that we had a chance. So I think it was, you know, well worth taking that chance. And I remember we decided to go, as you guys had, I think, to go unroped and to, you know, try and move a bit faster up the slope, which we did in the end. So yeah, at the end of the day, it turned out to be a good decision.
And Rob and Stu, I think you both caught us up towards the summit, and at the end of the day, all four of us ended up standing on top of Australia's highest peak, its only active volcano, 2,745 or 50 metres. How was that feeling after all that had gone before us? The sea travel, the conditions, the previous day, the illness. Describe the feeling, Rob.
Well, it was surreal. I mean, to have, you know, aimed for this goal for so long, and in some ways, without being defeatist, but telling yourself in the back of your mind that, look, you may not get up, you know, you may not get up the mountain in the end, to actually be standing on the top, it was just a feeling of elation, I think, and just of the achievement. And, you know, I remember it just being awesome to be there, you know, the four of us, again, in the middle of nowhere, looking down on the plateau of Big Ben and looking down at the island below us. So it was pretty incredible. I can still remember it quite vividly.
And Matt?
Yeah, I think the same. There was a great sense of achievement in getting up. There was a sense of relief in getting to the top as well. When you get to the top of a mountain, you know, it's great, because then you can start to go down towards warmth and food and safety. But yeah, I think for me, overwhelmingly, it was just a sense of the friendship that we had. There's a concept in mountaineering called the rope, which is really, it's not the actual physical rope, it's the people that are joined by the rope, it's the climbing team. And, you know, we had a small team, the four of us. Often these sorts of things are done in much larger groups. The two previous expeditions had numbered in the, you know, 10 to 20s. We had a small team, and I think that in itself made it really special. We were good mates before we started. I think we can say we were better mates by the end of it, but it was just a great experience to go through, both the suffering of much of the trip, but also the elation of getting to the summit. Yeah,
there was one chemical downside of being on the summit, Rob.
Yeah, it was pretty stinky up there with sulfur, you know, kind of fumes or whatever those fumes were coming out of the top of the volcano. I actually remember someone, it might have been Matt, in fact, when we were back in Mauritius, saying maybe we should get some kind of masks, etc., for the top of the mountain, and not really giving it too much thought. But in fact, that probably would have been sensible. And I recall having to kind of retreat down on the windward side of the summit a few metres to get out of that very kind of stinky and toxic environment that was on the top.
And more lava flowing as well. It was fascinating just to be right there at the standing on the top of an active volcano. Quite incredible. And we had a little option after that. We pretty much needed to clear all the way off that mountain, at least to advance base camp and maybe to base camp, Matt.
Yeah, so there's a good saying in mountaineering that when you get to the top, you've only climbed half the mountain. And it's a good thing to remember just in terms of the safety. Just people often let their guard down or they think it's all over. But really, you know, you've got half the climb to go. And particularly for us, we wanted to get down off the mountain as low as we could, because we knew this good weather wasn't going to hold. And we needed to take all our stuff down as well, and so we had a lot of gear back in our top camp and the lower camps. And so yeah, it was a big effort and a very big day. And again, we've had big days before in the army doing other things, but That was a particularly exhausting day that we had that day.
Mm. And Rob, unlike some other expedition locations, you can't leave anything on the island, so it wasn't as if we could clear out and leave things behind.
That's right, yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, our environmental permit, you know, the legal side of it said that we weren't to leave anything there. So we had to strip the mountain, and we'd taken some bamboo marker wands that we'd made. Actually, we'd cut these wands out of the garden of one of the embassy staff in Mauritius, and then we treated them in bleach to make sure they weren't carrying anything that shouldn't go to the island. So we had to retrieve all of these marker wands that we'd used, and obviously we had to, you know, recover all of our tents and sleeping gear and so on as well. So as we went down the mountain, our loads got heavier and heavier as we recovered equipment.
Mm. And we stumbled after what Matt mentions was a very long day. We stumbled into base camp late that night, albeit still light because of the summer period. And I think we collapsed into sleeping bags, noting that we had absolutely shredded and destroyed tents completely by that particular point in time. And from memory, we stayed in our sleeping bags all of the next day.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's pretty tired. Stu, who probably of the four of us is still the fittest and best of us in terms of the physicality. I've done lots of expeditions with him, and he's just hard to stop. You just never see him looking tired. And I'm pleased to say I saw him looking pretty tired when we finally got off the mountain. And I've got a treasured photo of Stu slumped with a big load still on his back as we hit base camp. Which is about the only time I've ever seen him actually looking a bit weary.
We had a few days before we left the island. We radioed to the ship and explained to them that we'd summited and did some coordination. And importantly, Matt, we communicated back home. How did we do that?
Yeah, well, again, I was managing most of the comms and the technology. We were keen to talk back home. We were very keen to talk to the boat, though. This is the one thing the captain of the ship had made a couple of jokes about, that if he didn't pick us up, there was another boat coming in 3 months' time that could also pick us up. So I think we had three separate means of communication with the boat, different radios and satellite phones. But yeah, calling home was great. We got to just on a sat phone. We got to talk to all the people that we'd left behind.
Mm. And those 16 days, we had a few days at the end, Rob, and we did a little bit of localised sightseeing, looking at some flora and fauna.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I just remember that, you know, it's fantastic, that experience. We had a pretty hard time on the mountain, and then you're back down at the relatively warm level of the sea. And yeah, we had a fantastic opportunity to wander around and explore a bit, put the Zodiacs on the water, and went for a bit of a zip around the local coastline. And I remember in a great effort, Matt went off and traversed a couple of the smaller peaks out on the Lawrence Peninsula, I think it was, near where we were. So, yeah, so we just enjoyed the next few days of cooking up very large meals, drinking lots and lots of brews, and enjoying being in this kind of amazing sub-Antarctic wilderness.
And over the horizon comes the Southern Champion, and perhaps in a fitting closure to that particular expedition, they had also had a highly successful fishing operation and had filled their hold. Thinking back 20 years ago, what are your reflections, Matt, on that particular expedition?
Oh, it still remains the best trip I think I've done. I've done lots of other expeditions in the Himalaya and other places, to higher mountains, perhaps to harder mountains, but Heard was special because of its uniqueness, the uniqueness of the location, the wildlife, the way we got down there and got back was amazing, but also just the tightness of the team. It was a great crew, and it was a It was also a unique achievement to be the third ever people to stand on the summit of such a substantial and remote peak was pretty special, and it was a great great experience, and one that I often reflect on.
And you're available for slideshows at short notice.
Absolutely.
And Rob, your reflections 20 years ago.
Yeah, very similar stuff, Tim, very similar stuff. I mean, for me, it was about being in this amazing sub-Antarctic environment that not many people get to experience. And it was, for all of us, the first experience of that environment. We'd climbed the mountain, so we'd achieved the objective, which was always very far from a sure thing. And it was fantastic being there with a bunch of mates as well. So, you know, we came back probably a tighter team than we went away. So all of those elements for me made it definitely the most memorable and the best trip I've done.
It's a beautiful place to leave it. Matt, Rob Clifton, thanks very much for being on the Unforgiving 60 podcast.
No worries. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers. All you businessmen, politicians, get a